Have you ever been assigned a patient that winds up being not so cut and dry? Like those patients in acute care or the nursing home who have dysphagia but struggle to complete exercises or compensatory strategies because of their intellectual or developmental disability? Or the patient with respiratory failure who develops respiratory-driven cardiac arrest, gets intubated for 10 plus days, and is on a trach and vent. Oh, and he also has a history of stroke, congestive heart failure, COPD, diabetes, and traumatic brain injury. No textbook or single webinar could ever prepare you for that. But we have something that can help you get there, and it's totally free. On May 19th, the MedSLP Collective is hosting another never-been-done-before virtual summit titled Advanced Therapy for Complex Patients, a Medical SLP's Guide. Learn critical concepts with actionable steps you can take for those not-so-cut-and-dry cases. You can earn up to 0.8 advanced ASHA CEUs if you are or you become a member of the MedSLP Collective, and the recording is also available inside of the collective. Ready to scale your clinical skills? Go to medslpcollective.com/summit to register today.
I do not care about swallowing. I hate swallowing. And I'm like, I hate aphasia. So I had to share that because I think it's so funny that you can have such different patient interests, but I think our foundational core beliefs about this profession and about helping patients get the services they need and deserve, I think are completely 100% aligned. So
very theoretical when it comes to language processing models and trying to determine specific linguistic breakdowns. We can take all this information and apply it in a way it helps our clients return to the life activities that they want to engage in.
I love watching sort of an entire conversation with you unfold from knowing the neuroanatomy, knowing the underlying pathophysiology of something, all the way to how does it look in this patient's life as a functional mechanism today.
Welcome to the Swallow Your Pride podcast. I'm your host, Teresa Richard. I'm a board-certified specialist in swallowing and swallowing disorders, and founder of the MedSLP Collective and MedSLP Education. This podcast is dedicated to delivering the latest evidence-based practice to medical SLPs everywhere, while also recognizing that medical SLPs everywhere are doing the best with what they've got. Whether you are a new clinician seeking tangible tools for therapy or a seasoned vet stuck in a rut, my goal is simple: to help you advance your practice without feeling overwhelmed or underappreciated. This means that together we'll build confidence, broaden your knowledge, and reignite your passion for our field. So if you're listening, I encourage you to swallow your pride and be open to new ideas, because at the end of the day, you and your patients deserve that kind of support. With that, let's dive
in. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited to have you. So today's podcast, you are not on the wrong channel. You are not on a totally different podcast. We are completely going rogue today. We are going so far off topic, but I'm excited. So Brett has got to be one of my most favorite human beings in the entire universe, let alone SLP. But it's so funny because he and I could not be any like polar opposites professionally. Like, he is all about aphasia and language and just, but he's so well-spoken, and it actually makes you want to learn more about that stuff, even though I really genuinely do not want to learn more about that stuff. That's horrible of me to say. And so Brett and I were sitting across from each other at dinner at ASHA, and he's like, I do not care about swallowing. I hate swallowing. And I'm like, I hate aphasia. So I had to share that because I think it's so funny that you can have such different patient interests, but I think our foundational core beliefs about this profession and about helping patients get the services they need and deserve, I think are completely 100% aligned. So thank you so much, my friend, for being here. If you want to share a few words about yourself.
Yeah, thanks so much. So like you're saying, I think that's cool about our field, that it's so broad that we can all kind of follow our each individual interests and really do best by our clients by really focusing on what is the most interesting and things that we're most passionate about. So again, thank you so much for having me on. I'm super pumped to be here. My name is Brett McArdle, and I'm an SLP and the owner of a private practice called Archways Aphasia Rehabilitation Services, which primarily serves people with aphasia. So when it comes to my approach towards aphasia treatment, I'm a big proponent of the life participation approach to aphasia, where we're making therapy immediately functional and relevant for our clients. So even though aphasia treatment can get very theoretical when it comes to language processing models and trying to determine specific linguistic breakdowns, we can take all this information and apply it in a way that helps our clients return to the life activities that they want to engage in and live their life to the fullest. So whether that's being more engaged in their weekly gardening club or being able to follow up the written instructions of a favorite recipe, treatment sessions really focus on helping people get back to living the life they want to live. So to me, that's what makes aphasia therapy so fun, is that you're taking all this linguistic knowledge and applying it in a way that makes sessions very meaningful and client-centered.
Awesome. I love it, my friend. I think one thing I appreciate so much about you, I love reading your posts. Brett's one of our mentors in the MedSLP Collective, is how you really also bring it back to the neuro. So I love watching sort of an entire conversation with you unfold from knowing the neuroanatomy, knowing the underlying pathophysiology of something, all the way to how does it look in this patient's life as a functional mechanism today. And I think you do such a beautiful job of walking that line of really scientific clinician to, okay, how can we just help this person get back to doing what they truly love? And so I really appreciate your take on those.
Yeah, thank you. You know, I think it's our field is so challenging because there's so much to know about everything. And even within the, you know, specific patient populations we work with, there is so much theory that we need to have a good grasp on. And of course, that's super important to really understand what it is that you're looking at, but then really kind of taking a step back and seeing how does this really matter in day-to-day life? And how can we, you know, do the most in our treatment sessions to make sure that treatment is really functional and immediately relevant to our clients?
Yeah. All right. So like I said, we're going completely rogue today. Not only are we diving way off the dysphagia cliff into aphasia, but we're actually going to be talking about math today. Something I never in a bajillion years thought that we would be talking about here. It's funny. I always loved math. I was really good at math in college, but it was one of those things that I was good at and like absolutely hated. Like I didn't do my homework. I was super lazy. I was a horrible, horrible student when it came to it just because I purely didn't like it. So really funny. We're doing an entire podcast on this today. So Brett and I, before we recorded, we're trying to figure out how to pronounce this. So if anybody is a pronunciation guru and we don't say it to your liking, I apologize. What did we say, Brett? It's a calculia. And how else did you say it?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is one of those words that it can be pronounced different ways. So similar to like tinnitus or tinnitus, can either say it's a calculia or a calculia. And either one is totally fine. And even I will say it differently, kind of depending on the context.
Okay. All right. So tomato, tomato, what the heck is it?
100%. Yeah. I'm going to say a calculia for most of this.
Okay. All right. So yeah. So tell us a little bit about what it is and why we're talking about it today.
Yeah. You know, I am so excited to be talking about this today. This is such a under-addressed topic in aphasia management. And I think it is an area that our clients really want to spend some time on in treatment sessions, but I don't think there's a whole lot of easily accessible resources out there for clinicians to address it. So acalculia is an acquired neurological disorder that can cause impairments in any of the three subdomains of the numerical system. So that includes number processing, calculation, and problem solving. So acalculia is, you know, typically the result of brain damage of various reasons like stroke or head injury. And spontaneous recovery is possible within the first few months of onset, but it can also be a chronic condition that has a significant impact on daily functioning and quality of life. So each person with acalculia is different and will have their own unique set of strengths and weaknesses. But general symptoms are going to include things like difficulties estimating and understanding numbers, having impaired knowledge of mathematical facts, and then having trouble performing calculations. And what's even more interesting is that our clients might have different performance with math-related tasks depending on the numerical format used. So numbers are typically represented in three different ways in English. It's either going to be as an Arabic numeral, a spoken number word where we say a number aloud, or as a written number word where we spell and write out a number. So there can be drastically different performance between these three modalities for a client, where maybe someone does really well with Arabic numerals but cannot write the name of the number, or maybe someone does really well writing down number words in the Arabic numerals, but has a hard time saying or understanding spoken numbers. And this is also true for mathematical signs and operations as well. Some people might have specific signs preserved, while other signs are pretty much inaccessible. So again, maybe someone is really good with addition, they understand what the sign means, and they can perform simple addition facts just fine, but subtraction is extremely poor. And the same could go for multiplication and division. So overall, in acalculia, there's just a really interesting constellation of symptoms that can happen as it relates to numbers and calculation skills. And I'll say, you know, today I'm going to mainly focus on acalculia and aphasia, but there are specific error patterns and relative weaknesses that have been seen in other neurological conditions like ALS and Alzheimer's disease as well. But again, this is a under-addressed topic in aphasia management and something that our clients really report wanting to work on more. So I'm hopeful that this kind of gives some introductions, different assessment tools and treatment techniques that clinicians can kind of add to their clinical toolkit to help address this area better in their treatment sessions.
Yeah, awesome. Talk to me a little bit, Brett, about sort of how you really got interested in learning more about this topic. Were you noticing just having patients coming in and really struggling with this, or was this something that you just sort of seemed to connect the pieces with?
Yeah, you know, I would say I really kind of started diving into this about maybe a year and a half ago. I started having more clients endorse wanting to work on numbers. And it was something that was very new to me at the time. I didn't know too much about it. I had some maybe ideas about how to address it in treatment sessions, but really didn't have any good resources to go towards. So I really just went down a big PubMed rabbit hole. I started reading lots and lots of research. And what's really interesting is it seems like there was really big momentum in acalculia management in like the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. And then there's kind of been a pause recently in the research literature. So I'm hopeful that more stuff starts to come out. But I would say overall, it's just been a really interesting way to kind of dive into an area that is definitely related to aphasia. I'll kind of talk about later on the prevalence of acalculia within aphasia. But it's just been kind of intellectually really fun to learn more about this, but then to see how math and language are related to each other and just kind of dive more into that as well.
Yeah, awesome. All right, so where do we start? Guessing with assessment.
We can. You know, and even before that, I'll kind of talk a little bit about the impacts that acalculia has on quality of life. Yeah. You know, again, this is a really overlooked area of clinical care. And that's unfortunate because, you know, it's estimated that acalculia impacts anywhere between 30 to 60% of stroke survivors, which is comparable to aphasia, which impacts about a third of stroke survivors. And relatively speaking, there's not as much support for acalculia as there is aphasia. And, you know, the reason for this, probably multifactorial. One factor being that there's just generally a much sparser evidence base for assessment and treatment purposes. And there's not as much work that's been done when compared to the aphasia literature. But another interesting factor to think about too is maybe the potential social stigma that comes with math, because in the treatment literature, there's talk about how reporting difficulty with math is more acceptable than reporting difficulty with reading. So there may not be as pressing of an urge to address these issues compared to other issues following, you know, a neurological event. You know, overall, people with chronic acalculia, they experience really significant negative impacts on their ability to function in daily life. And this makes it harder to complete daily life activities like telling the time or communicating details about events or, you know, reading figures on documents. And, you know, what's kind of interesting is that some researchers actually suggest that having poor numeracy skills is even more debilitating than having poor literacy skills. And there's a really great qualitative study from Ben and colleagues in 2022 that focuses on the psychosocial and emotional impact of acalculia. And in this study, a lot of their participants reported feelings of vulnerability, shame, frustration. And they also talked about just the lack of professional awareness and services available for acalculia management, with a lot of the participants saying that the professionals they were seeing, like SLPs and occupational therapists, didn't have a whole lot to offer in terms of meaningful intervention or referrals to other professionals to help with this issue. And I think that stems more from just a general lack of knowledge about what is out there when it comes to assessment and treatment. So again, definitely an area that people want to address in their treatment plans, and one in which SLPs and OTs can play a part.
It's just another thing we'll just plop on the SLP's plate.
100%, exactly.
I can't get over how we went from swallowing today to talking about math and numbers tomorrow, but here we are. So.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny you bring that up, because I think that's kind of a good segue into talking about what exactly is the relationship between math and language.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you. I summed that up nicely for you.
And, you know, it's funny. So from a philosophical perspective, there are some very strong arguments to be made that math is a language. So from a macro perspective, we consider something a language when there's a system that has vocabulary, grammar, syntax, and people who use and understand it. So when we take these components and apply it to math, you know, at its core, numbers represent meaning. They represent quantity. So just like spoken words and written words convey meaning, so too do spoken numbers and written numbers. So these numbers are part of the vocabulary of math. And when we combine numbers together to make multi-digit numbers, like the number 127, that has its own syntax. And this syntax allows us to know what the specific placement of a digit within a number means. So for the example of 127, the 1 is in the hundreds place, the 2 is in the tens place, and the 7 is in the ones place. So again, there are syntactical rules for numbers that need to be structured. And the same is true when we think about the grammar as well. So for the grammar of math, let's say you have a larger number like 1,450. You have a comma that comes between the 1 and the 4. And again, the grammatical structure of a comma is rule-based. You always need a comma to denote the break between the hundreds and the thousandths place. So in these regards, math is very similar to language in that it represents meaning, it's rule-based in how we use it, and we can communicate with others when we're using it. Now that's kind of, again, from a more philosophical viewpoint. When we think about the neuroimaging literature and where math is represented in the brain, you know, numerical knowledge and processing is mostly independent of other types of knowledge in the brain, like language and memory. And several studies do suggest that there's a dissociation between aphasia and acalculia. There's actually a really cool article from 1995, the researchers Roser, I believe, and they report a case of severe aphasia who answered simple addition, subtraction, and multiplication problems correctly, and even performed multi-digit operations without any problems at all. So when we think more about the neuroimaging literature specifically, those studies do suggest that there's distinct non-linguistic cortical regions for mathematical knowledge. But that being said, language and math do share cognitive resources depending on the task. And we see this especially in math tasks that are more verbal in nature, like digit transcoding, where a person's asked to read aloud the written Arabic numeral that they see on a page, and then transcode that into either a written word or a spoken word. And this kind of task relies on a lot of different cognitive functions, which include language, visual spatial skills, memory, attention, and executive function. So because of this, it's been suggested that acalculia symptoms are commonly seen in aphasia because of the involvement of the left hemisphere in verbal processing of math problems seen in real life.
Totally fascinating.
It is. And, you know, there's actually kind of a long history of acalculia. You know, the very first published case of an individual who had severe calculation disorder without any linguistic impairment came from 1908 And then the term itself, acalculia, was coined in 1925 by Hinchin and colleagues. And as more research has been done over the years, it's been seen that different people with acalculia make all sorts of types of errors. And sometimes there are patterns of errors that emerge between people. And this has given rise to different classification systems for acalculia that have been developed over the years. And I would say the most comprehensive and current classification system comes from Ardila and Rosselli in 2002. And they have a system of classifying acalculia into two camps, depending on the reason for the math problems. You either have primary acalculia or secondary acalculia. Now, primary acalculia, these are fundamental impairments in understanding numerical concepts and performing mathematical operations, while secondary acalculia is difficulty with numerical abilities because of issues with either language, attention, reading, writing, or other cognitive impairments.
Brett, can you talk to me a little bit about, are there any specific classification systems that acalculia is usually associated with? Are there specific, you know, brain damage? Is there specific deficits that we see that usually goes along with this characteristic?
Yeah, absolutely. So taking that classification we just talked about, primary and secondary acalculias, primary acalculia, sometimes you'll see it referred to as anarrhythmetria in the research literature. Again, this is an impairment in understanding how the numerical system is organized, and there are fundamental calculation deficits in both oral and written modalities. So for primary acalculia, the traditional lesion location is going to be the left posterior parietal area, especially if there are lesions in either the angioparietal sulcus or the left angular gyrus. And typical symptoms you're going to see in primary acalculia are going to be difficulties with numerical concepts, having trouble understanding number quantity, having trouble understanding different mathematical symbols like the plus sign or the minus sign. And these people even have trouble with what's called tactile enumeration, which is being able to count by touch. So primary acalculia, again, this can be present without language impairment, but it is significantly correlated with aphasia. So in these cases, you'll have people with aphasia who have difficulty with numbers because of the verbal interference from the aphasia, as well as having fundamental disruptions in understanding those numerical concepts we just talked about. So again, that's primary acalculia. And then we've got secondary acalculia. And secondary acalculia is kind of an umbrella term for a variety of different acalculia classifications. The first of them that I'll talk about is aphasic acalculia. And this is when someone is having mathematical problems that come from linguistic problems like we see in aphasia. So the types of errors people might make in aphasic acalculia might be semantic errors, where someone sees the number 100, but then they read it as 10. They might have syntax errors, where again, they don't quite understand how the order of numbers within a multi-digit number contributes to quantity. And they might also have morphological errors, where again, the number 15 is written down, but it's read as 50. So that's aphasic acalculia. Another type of secondary acalculia might be alexic acalculia. And this is someone's going to have problems with math that come from reading difficulties, acquired reading difficulties. So here we might see people who perform digit by digit reading. So the number 359 might be read as 359. And these clients will likely have problems reading longer and longer digit spans. Now, similar to alexic acalculia, there's also agraphic acalculia, which is when people have math problems that arise from writing difficulties. And so here, our clients will have problems with writing to dictation tasks, and the types of errors we'll see might be number omissions, where they leave numbers out. There might be fragmentation when someone goes down to write 25, but instead they literally write it as 20 and then 5. And there'll also be just some illegibility from having motor impairment for writing skills. Another one I'll talk about too, another secondary acalculia, is frontal or dysexecutive acalculia. And this is calculation problems that come from executive functioning problems. So these types of client profiles will see people having a hard time maintaining focus on a task because of attentional impairments, and they'll really have problems with complex mathematical concepts, even though more fundamental arithmetic skills might be preserved. And then the last of the classifications to talk about is called spatial acalculia. This is a really interesting one. This is calculation problems that come from spatial neglect. So here, mental calculation skills are going to be far superior to any calculation skills involving reading or writing. And the types of errors here we might see might be exclusive overuse of one half of the page. There might be digit iterations where the person's writing the same digit over and over. There might be feature iterations where a person goes to write a number, but then they keep on adding features to it. So for example, if they write the number 3, they may keep on making more loops than is necessary within that number. You might also see difficulty maintaining horizontal lines, having just general spatial disorganization, and then writing over segments of the page that have already been used. So again, there are lots of different types of acalculia classifications with these specific patterns of errors. But that being said, you know, overlap definitely exists between these subtypes. So not everyone's going to fit nice and neatly into a specific classification. And, you know, even within classification types, everyone's specific strengths and weaknesses will be different when it comes to their mathematical abilities. So it just really kind of, again, reinforces the idea that we need to make our evaluations very in-depth and patient-centered so we get a really good idea of what our clients' individual strengths and weaknesses are when it comes to their mathematical abilities.
Awesome. Thanks, Brett. You make this stuff sound so interesting.
Because it is. Which is so cool.
It is. It's the concept of it, I think, just is, I don't know. It's wild. Like, obviously, we know this is, we see this with our patients all the time, but yeah. Thank you for defining it, I think, and presenting it in a very nice package is what I'm trying to say. So.
Oh, anytime. No, thank you.
Yeah. All right. So where do we go from here?
You know, I think we should probably hop into assessments. Before we do, though, I do want to say that, you know, I just talked about the classification systems, but if people really do want to learn more about how we might conceptualize acalculia, I think there are two models that are really helpful. And I think it's kind of maybe beyond the purview of this podcast episode to go super in-depth in these models, but I think two models that people would really want to take a look into will be McCloskey's model of numerical processing and then something called the triple code model. So these are two neuropsychological models that explain number processing in different ways. And it can be really helpful to read about these models and understand how they work, because when we're doing our assessment, you can start to plot, okay, this person has problems with this type of math skill, which means in this model, this component is broken. So it's a way that we can kind of put on paper and really visualize what's going on with our client's specific math difficulties and kind of help us just get a grasp on what's going on for something that is so theoretically dense and difficult to visualize. These models give us a good anchor for us to have an idea of how exactly we can characterize what's going on with our clients and what specifically can we do in treatments to address some of these weaknesses. So again, those are models that would be helpful for people to check out if they want to learn more about this. When it comes to the actual assessment process for acalculia, you know, our assessments, they have three primary objectives. We first want to confirm the presence of acalculia. We want to determine the type of acalculia our client might have. And then we also want to get a better understanding of our client's individual mathematical strengths and weaknesses so that we can develop a really individualized treatment plan. And, you know, just as when we're working with our clients on literacy, reading and writing acquired reading and writing disorders. We do want to make sure that as part of our assessment, we're getting information about our clients' mathematics education and their daily use of numbers before they start having these symptoms. So that way we can compare this to any, you know, post-onset problems they might be having when it comes to their mathematical functioning. This is going to give us a better idea of what our client's mathematical baseline is before they acquired this acalculia and help us with setting appropriate goals.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing this. This reminds me of a patient that I had actually in grad school when we were in grad school clinic. Mm-hmm. And he was like one of my most memorable patients with aphasia that I ever had. And he said something to me, you know, like he struggles with numbers and he just struggles with simple math now. And that just, you know, didn't used to be difficult for him. And, at the time I probably said some unprofessional joke, like, well, you know, who cares about numbers or math anyways? And he was like, well, I was an accountant, so it's pretty important to me. And it has been important to me. And that was a good lesson in, you know, insert foot and mouth. But it's important that, yeah, I mean, imagine that. Imagine being somebody that, you know, doesn't care about math at all, but, or somebody that was an accountant, that their life literally revolves around numbers and how debilitating and demoralizing this condition could now be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can only imagine how terrifying it is to not be able to do something that was so effortless before your stroke. And now all of a sudden, I can't tell what the time is. I don't know, you know, how to type in the phone number. I can't tell you my address. I mean, there's so much that we just take for granted that I just become so difficult after brain injury. So again, I'm really hopeful that more research is done in this area and that clinicians start to feel more confident in addressing this in sessions, because again, it seems so simple and so kind of like, you know, there's just so much that can be done for these kind of issues. And I'm hopeful that we really
start. It reminds me of a conversation. I might have mentioned this on a previous podcast, but there was some researcher that I was talking to, and I just said, you know, what is sort of your biggest fear? Or I can't remember where the context of this came from. So editor, please edit part of this garbage out. But there was a conversation and the researcher said, you know, my biggest fear in life is that someone doesn't get attached to my research and continue on my legacy.
Yeah.
And this, when you said something like, you know, this was sort of studied heavily in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and then there hasn't been much since. It's like, can somebody please pick this back up? Like, is there, you know, is there just not many people that are really interested in it right now? And that just made me think of that.
100%. You know, I'm not really sure why it hasn't kept up the momentum. You know, I will say very recently, like in the last couple of years, it started to get more momentum. There's some new treatment techniques that have been developed, and there's new assessment tools currently being developed, so it's getting picked back up. I'm not sure why there's sort of a pause, if you would, but I am very hopeful that this becomes more and more prioritized in the research literature.
All right.
So again, when we're doing our assessments, just like we're doing an aphasia assessment, we've got some assessment tools that are more impairment based. So these are tools that are going to be looking solely at mathematical abilities. We got some assessment tools that are participation based. So these are looking at how your client does with what we might refer to as numerical activities of daily living, like telling the time or using money. And then there's also some great quality of life assessments that we can look at to better get an idea of kind of the psychosocial impact that the acalculia is having on our clients. So by incorporating all these different types of tools, you get a really holistic view of how these symptoms are impacting your client as a whole. So to dive in with the impairment-based assessments, there are a couple out there. You know, some of the more popular ones include the Johns Hopkins University Dyscalculia Battery. There's something called the EC301 Battery. But the one that I use the most in my own practice is called the Number Processing and Calculation Battery. And the authors of this are Delazare from 2003, and the whole battery is available from the appendix of that paper. And this is a really neat battery. So again, the Number Processing and Calculation Battery, it's made up of 35 different subtests looking at all sorts of number processing and mathematical skills, all the way from really foundational skills like number transcoding, again, being able to look at an Arabic numeral and then turn it into a spoken number word, Again, foundational skills like comparing number sizes. And this test also looks at more complex tasks like solving word problems or even understanding arithmetic principles. So this is a assessment I would really encourage people to check out. It was normed on a sample of 282 adults without brain injury. So it's just a really powerful tool, I find, to get a nice, clear picture of what are the mathematical strengths and weaknesses of my clients, again, from an impairment-based perspective. When it comes to participation-based tools, again, we're looking to see how someone does with numerical activities of daily living. There's actually a test called the Numerical Activities of Daily Living, and this gives us a more objective measurement of how people perform on math-related activities of daily living. This is a really cool assessment because it includes interview questions for both the clients and the caregiver, and they ask things about how, you know, the impacts that acalculia has had on daily routines. And this is a neat test because it also has a financial version available. So if you're looking specifically at how, you know, money management is going for your client post-stroke, this is a test you could consider looking into as well. And there's also a short form of the battery. So if you need something a little bit quicker, there is a short form available for use. The one caveat I'll put is that this test was not developed in the United States, so it's going to be using measurements and currency and units that we do not use in the US, like the euro and the kilogram. But that being said, you can modify these questions and then use assessment for qualitative purposes. But again, this is a really great test, great kind of look into more psychosocial issues with the interviews. And then a lot of the math-related ADL tasks revolve around, you know, questions related to time, measurements, money management, transportation, and communication as it relates to numbers and math. So a great tool you can use to get a more objective look into how things are going on more of a daily basis for your clients with their acalculia symptoms. And then...
Gosh, that's so... Yeah, now that you think about it, it's just how many things do we do daily that are all mathematical based. So yeah. Thank you, Brett. Yeah, it's incredibly valuable.
Absolutely. And then when it comes to actual prompts or patient reported outcome measurements or quality of life assessments, there are two tools that I've been using in my practice. The first is the ASHA FACTS, so the ASHA Functional Assessment of Communication Skills for Adults. This has a couple of questions specifically relating to mathematical abilities. But one tool that I think is really cool, it's called the Subjective Numeracy Scale. And this is a self-report questionnaire that's examining the ability to perform different numerical tasks and ask our clients their preference for how numerical information is provided, whether they want it in Arabic numerals, they want it more as written number words or spoken number words. So again, it's really important we think about these quality of life assessments so that we can get a more holistic view of our clients. And then also have tools that we can use as outcome measurements to help us see what impact our treatment sessions are having and help us know if we need to either keep on going with what we're doing in treatment or if we need to kind of change course and try a different approach. So that is pretty much the main highlights for assessments. And now I'll kind of talk about the treatment approaches we have for acalculia. So
right.
In the treatment literature, mainly focused around three different areas for treatment. A lot of studies look at number transcoding. Again, being able to transcode from one numerical format to another, mathematical fact retrieval, and then calculation. So again, there are several different studies that have looked at number transcoding, but the one that I really want to highlight is a really brand new one, actually, by LaManna Sear and colleagues, 2023. And they are targeting number transcoding through what we might think of as a multi-component approach, where different aspects of numerical processing are all targeted within the protocol. And tasks in the protocol include things like reading numbers aloud, copying numbers, and demonstrating understanding of number quantity through the use of tools like base 10 sets, which are basically, you might even think of them as like Lego blocks that kind of visualize numbers. So what I really like about this approach is that it not only focuses on number transcoding, but it also incorporates a lot of metacognitive aspects to help build awareness and successful use of different types of supports people might use. So again, you're going to help your client identify the most common errors they tend to make during these number transcoding tasks and help build their awareness of them. And then you'll brainstorm with the clients in order to identify situations in daily life where this specific type of transcoding task you're working on is required, and identify what kind of effective supports are available for your clients and talk about how, when, and why to use these supports. And so when we're thinking about what these supports could be, you know, we do have some AAC options available to us for Acalculia. One of the options might be using tools traditionally made for vision loss that talk aloud. So using talking watches, maybe if someone's working with following a recipe, you might use talking kitchen scales. There are phones that are not smartphones that speak digits aloud. Of course, we also have calculators available to us. And then if you do have a client who uses smartphones, there, of course, are smartphone accessibility features, including text-to-speech and speech-to-text. And if you are working with maybe someone who is back in school or needs to use math at a higher level, either for work purposes or daily life purposes, there are two apps I'd recommend looking into. They're called PhotoMath and then MyScript Calculator. And these are really powerful apps that can help walk you through a math problem and kind of give you step-by-step what's going on. So again, a great tool to use if you have someone either returning to school after a brain injury or maybe needs to use more higher level math in their day-to-day profession or just day-to-day life. So that's, you know, one approach for number transcoding I really think is cool. Again, La Manassière, 2023. When it comes to mathematical fact retrieval and calculation, you know, generally the research literature focuses on two types of approaches. We have drill-based approaches where mathematical facts are targeted through intensive repetition, and then conceptual approaches where mathematical principles are taught and then backup strategies are trained. So, of course, I think for most of our clients, they benefit from both the drill-based approach and a conceptual approach as a way to kind of target math processes from all sorts of different angles. Again, a variety of different treatment studies have looked at both of these. And then again, I think using both approaches can be helpful for our clients as a way to get back to the mathematical abilities they need to use in everyday life.
Awesome. I love this, Brett.
Yeah, it's really...
Like after a conversation with you, you like make me want to get back into like language and aphasia, and like no other person could ever do that. So
I do it because it's the best.
But actually, like I said, I just love how you make it so relevant, and it really, you know, I can't imagine this. So thank you.
Anytime.
All right. I think that was like the most comprehensive overview of a condition that no one's ever heard of that we've ever had on this podcast. So thank you. Because I think that was very easily digestible as far as, you know, what it looks like from a patient perspective, what it looks like from, you know, the neurological deficits, the PROMs that we can use, assessment, and then treatment. So thank you so much. That was hopefully give people a really, really, really good idea of where to start. And we'll make sure that we have all of this information in the show notes. Anything else? Anything else that we want to cover?
You know, I think that pretty much covers it for this episode. I got to say, just again, thank you so much for allowing me to be on here. This is an area, again, I think that we are all professionally, we can address this in our sessions. Once you learn more about different tools and resources out there, I definitely encourage you to look more into this because it is an area that our clients want to work on and that we can make a huge impact in our treatment sessions. So don't be overwhelmed. Just take it step by step. And I hope more people start addressing it.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that it's like, holy cow, I never thought I would be helping teach people math again in my career. But it's this is so relevant. And thank you so much for giving the language and philosophical background behind it, because it just makes so much sense that this is absolutely an area that we should be treating. And I know that's something that I don't like to have regrets, but I know that's something I always regret in my career, is that there's sometimes patients present with things that I didn't even know we were capable of treating, let alone being equipped to treat them. So thank you for bringing this to the forefront. And hopefully now we've equipped some people with some information to go ahead and help these patients. So thank you so much, Brett. I appreciate you as always.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been a blast.
And that's a wrap for this episode. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if you'd like to download the show notes from this episode, please visit swallowyourpridepodcast.com. There you can also sign up for our email list so that you'll never miss another episode. If you do like what you hear, then please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or share it on social media with your friends and colleagues, because that is what keeps these episodes coming. If you'd like to be a guest, share feedback, or request a topic to be discussed on the show, please email podcast@teresarichard.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week.